today on Against the Grain. The overtly racist politics of Donald Trump has been called unprecedented, a break from the Republican Party's past rules of engagement. But a look backward, particularly at the GOP's Southern strategy to woo white voters based on racist appeals, indicates how inaccurate that assumption is. I'm Sasha Lilly. Edward H. Miller will discuss with me the origins of the Southern strategy in segregated Dallas and how the ideas of Texas ultra-conservatives became the national politics of the Republican Party. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Many accounts of the rise of the right situate its emergence in response to the movements of the 1960s, from women's liberation to black power to fears of the counterculture. But scholar Edward H. Miller traces its origins back a decade to segregated Dallas, Texas. There, ultra-conservatives, gripped by an apocalyptic vision of America in decline, reoriented the Republican Party, which had been the party of Abraham Lincoln and post-Civil War Reconstruction, to an explicitly racist outlook. That orientation, now known as the Southern Strategy, revolved around making pro-segregationist and racist appeals to white voters so that they would leave the Democratic Party, heretofore the party of segregation, and join the Republicans. In Nut Country, Right-Wing Dallas and the Birth of the Southern Strategy, Miller argues that before the explicit or more veiled racially charged politics of Goldwater, Nixon, Reagan, and Trump, the Republican Party of Dallas forged the way. Ted, let me start by asking you about Dallas in the 1950s. Can you tell us about the context in which this story takes place? What was the economy like? What dominated it? How dynamic was it?
Dallas in the 1950s and 1960s was a boom town. You have a number of individuals, families moving from the Midwest, and they're looking to work in finance. They're looking to work in oil. It has a significant manufacturing base that is based in aircraft manufacturing and post-war manufacturing. On the whole, they were a lot wealthier than the average American. The typical Dallas citizen was, on the whole, a lot wealthier than the average American. A lot of it had to do with oil. Dallas they had discovered oil in southeast Texas in the 1930s, and this period between 1930 and 1960 improved the economy considerably. Also, Dallas benefited as well from the seemingly never-ending supply of appropriations from the federal government during the military-industrial complex period of the 1950s and 1960s. Dallas got a lot of federal plums, especially for defense contracts.
And what was its racial history for listeners who may not know about Texas and Dallas particularly?
Dallas had a problematic racial history. Dallas was an epicenter of the second Ku Klux Klan of the 1920s. There were a considerable number of members of the Ku Klux Klan living in Dallas in the 1920s. The leader of the Ku Klux Klan called Dallas his home. There were individuals who lived in Dallas who were members of the Ku Klux Klan, who were police officers in the Dallas Police Department. So it had a significant problem problematic race history during the 1920s.
And then taking that history up until the 1950s, what was the history of Jim Crow in that region?
Well, as a southern state, Texas as a whole, generally supported segregation. There was an incident in 1956. This is following the passage of the landmark Brown versus Board Supreme Court decision, in which the Supreme Court, led by Justice Earl Warren, determined that segregation was no longer would no longer be in place in the United States, and Dallas and the areas around Dallas resisted that. There was a significant pushback in Mansfield, Texas, which is right outside of Dallas. There was an incident in which there was an attempted integration of the school district in Mansfield, and the citizens of Mansfield, led by those who would be called white supremacists, resisted considerably the sending of three black students to the school in August of 1956. And this had a direct impact on a very important election, which I argue is the beginning of the Southern strategy.
Right, and the Southern strategy being the shift that the Republican Party encouraged to peel white voters away from the Democratic Party by appealing to them along explicit or later more covert racial lines. So tell us about this election, and I believe you're talking about the re-election campaign of Dallas Republican Congressman Bruce Alger, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. So the Southern strategy, it's the effort by Republicans to get support among whites in the South. Keep in mind that it's very difficult for Republicans to get elected in the South after Reconstruction. It's nearly impossible. And Alger, he does the impossible almost. In 1954, he is able to win election. He's the first Republican congressman elected in Dallas since Reconstruction. And Bruce Alger is actually from Missouri, and he moves to Dallas with his family. He's a real estate man, and he runs for Congress in 1954, and he runs as a Eisenhower Republican. He supports the Republican policies of the popular President Eisenhower. He's more of a moderate in Congress at this particular time. He's a moderate on race. He's a he is a moderate on economic and fiscal policy. But in an important election in 1956, he demonstrated to the Republican Party that you could use racial strategies to capture white voters. His whole point was to make it very clear to African Americans that the Republican Party was not sympathetic to their interests. And Alger is really the first Republican who is able to do this. Now, as I said, at the time of his election, it's unheard of to have a Republican congressman from Dallas. But he's elected, actually becomes a very moderate congressman. His 1956 re-election campaign is very important for the racialization and the future Southern strategy of the Republican Party. It really marks the first time that a Southern Republican had abandoned a measured stance on segregation and embraced a segregationist position to maintain and then just build on his electoral coalition. He made this political decision to signal to these white voters that he was antagonistic toward the interests of civil rights and blacks.
And we're going to talk a lot more about this, the shift that you're describing, mm-hmm. and the Southern strategy. But I think it would be useful for listeners for us to back up for a moment and talk about the much longer historical trajectories of the Republican and Democratic parties, because I think it can be quite confusing. The Republican Party, as you have mentioned, or as you've alluded to, coming out of Reconstruction, was the party that had been the party of radical Reconstruction in the late 19th century, the party of Abraham Lincoln, and the Democrats had been the party bolstering up intense oppression of African Americans in the South. And a shift of sorts takes place, which all of this prefigures what you're talking about in the 1950s. Can you explain that to listeners? Because someone just knowing more contemporary history who might associate the Republican Party with covert or overt support of racial oppression, and the Democratic Party, at least in the North, as being somehow aligned with civil rights, might find all of this history a bit confusing.
Sure. So the Republican Party is the party of Abraham Lincoln. It is the party that is designed to, that opposes the extension of slavery throughout the West. It's also the party of Reconstruction. It's the party of Thaddeus Stevens, the party of Charles Sumner, who were radical Republicans. Following the Civil War, the Republican Party could fit into a phone booth in Texas. The Democrats were the only game in town. The Democrats were the only game in town or in the state. And conservative Democrats just dominated Texas politics during the first half of the 20th century. In Texas, no Republican from Texas had served in the United States Senate since 1877. No Republican had served in a Texas statewide office since 1874. And no Republican from Dallas County had served in the United States House of Representatives since Reconstruction. And so Republicans just always lost in Dallas because there was this association between the Republicans and Abraham Lincoln, and it was this association between the Republican Party and the military rule by the North during the period of Reconstruction.
Well, we'll talk further along in the program about the shifting positions of the Democratic and Republican parties as a result of, as you're arguing, the kinds of politics that came out of Dallas in the 1950s. And I should say that the program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with Edward H. Miller about his book, Nut Country, Right Wing Dallas and the Birth of the Southern Strategy, and that's published by the University of Chicago Press. So you were talking about the shift in the politics of Bruce Alger from a kind of moderate Republican stance to a much more conservative one, and what it really foreshadowed in terms of a much broader shift. That kind of indicates that there was a spectrum within the Republican Party of moderates and ultra-conservatives. And you argue that in some ways, although opposed to each other, they also had a somewhat symbiotic relationship with each other. Can you describe, just start by describing, what were the politics of moderate conservatism in the Republican Party in Dallas in the 1950s? What was their bread and butter? What were the issues that defined them in the 1950s?
They were interested in building the party, building the institutional apparatus in the party, finding candidates who could be elected in Texas and Dallas. They were interested in hosting candidates for coffee. They were very much interested in raising the funds for the Republican Party. They were not interested in absolutist politics. They were willing to compromise. They were not as intransigent when it came to policies. Now, given that, they were still moderate segregationists. They didn't believe in integration by any means. But compared to the ultra-conservative Republicans, and you sort of have to understand them in the context of the ultra-conservative Republicans, they were much more measurable. They were much more measured and willing to concede their positions than the ultra-conservatives. They would pursue compromise if it was necessary.
How did the, just staying for a moment with the moderate conservatives in the Republican Party in Texas, in Dallas, how did their politics differ from the policies and orientation of the Democratic Party? What were sort of the key differences?
Well, in many cases, you could have moderate Republicans who were to the left of Democrats on the issue of race during the first election that Congressman Alger of Dallas ran. He ran against somebody who was to the right of him on the issue of race. He ran in 1954, but he ran against a Democrat who was far to the right of him on the issue of race. Alger was more of a gradualist. So you could have a situation where you had a conservative Democrat who was more reactionary on the matter of race than a moderate Republican.
And that, in many ways, would flow from their histories. Is that right?
That's right.
The ultra-conservatives in Dallas, at least some of them, were particularly striking figures. Can you state in broad terms what motivated them? What kind of politics did the ultra-conservatives subscribe to? And what gave them and their politics a sense of urgency?
Well, the above anything else, the ultra-conservative Republicans would employ a lot of apocalyptic rhetoric. They were given to expressing themselves in the discourse of finality. For instance, it was W.A. Criswell, an important religious figure in Dallas, who said that the election of a Catholic as president, he was talking about JFK, would mean the end of religious freedom in America. For him, America was always on the verge of collapse. And I think that that attitude characterized a lot of the ultra-conservative Republicans. There was another ultra-conservative Republican by the name of Ida Darden, and she said in 1960, "It looks like it won't be long now," and she's talking about the end of freedom in the republic. Even though they were time and time again proved to be incorrect, they continued to believe this this sort of apocalyptic disaster scenario rhetoric.
Which seems to characterize kind of far-right politics in general, that, you know, America's always in its death throes. Do you think that came out of something religious, or was there something else as well going on?
Well, I wouldn't make a direct causal connection between religion and this apocalyptic rhetoric. Another example of this apocalyptic rhetoric is J. Evetts Haley, who is another ultra-conservative figure in Dallas. And he's saying that the 1964 Civil Rights Act is going to end the American Republic. But there were a number of these ultra-conservative Republicans, like Dan Smoot, who believed in premillennial dispensationalism, which proposed that the Bible foretold the end of the world. It's Dan Smoot, who's a premillennial dispensationalist. He's a member of the the non-dominant denominational Schofield Memorial Church, whose original pastor was premillennial dispensationalism's most important popularizer, Cyrus Schofield. I found in my research that many of the figures who were speaking in this apocalyptic language when it came to secular matters also subscribed to premillennial dispensationalism, this belief in the end times when it came to religious matters. H.L. Hunt is another example. H.L. Hunt is an oilman, a very popular ultra-conservative figure in Dallas, and he's a member of W.A. Criswell's Dispensationalist First Baptist Church, and I talk about that in the book.
Right, and this is a man who at the time was purported to be the wealthiest man in the world. How significant was he given his great wealth?
H.L. Hunt was very significant. He's a very active oil man. He's active in politics by the 1950s. Again, he's representing the ultra-conservative wing of the Dallas Republican Party. Some of the characteristics of these ultra-conservative Republicans, they are they peddle conspiracy theories. They employ a lot of this apocalyptic rhetoric. They thought in absolutist terms. It's H.L. Hunt who is, he believes that any type of liberalism is equivalent to communism. And I remember a quip from somebody. They said that H.L. Hunt thought that communism began in this country when the government took over the distribution of mail. So H.L. Hunt is, he rejects any type of compromise, like many of the ultra-conservative Republicans. He demands absolute victory over the Democrats, the communists, the fellow travelers, even the Republican establishment and the Eisenhower administration. But he has a significant impact because of his money. He is holding in East Texas a significant portion of the nation's oil reserves. And he uses this money to establish a real media empire. He had an organization called Facts Forum that's involved with television. It was involved with mail and radio. And he is a he fosters a number of his supporters and encourages a number of his supporters to go on and become ultra-conservative media icons in their own right. He had a relationship with Dan Smoot, who becomes a very active commentator on ultra-conservative politics. And Smoot is also filled with conspiracy theories and apocalyptic language that we're in our last days and this is our last gasp of liberty. Hunt has a large following in Dallas and throughout the country. His Facts Forum organization is followed by such stars as John Wayne and the CEO of Sears and Roebuck. But he's quite an eccentric, Hunt is. Apparently, he engaged in a type of exercise that he called creeping. And on the carpet of his office suite, he would crawl like an infant and to develop what he thought was some form of a higher brain function. He also thought he could, with the use of aloe vera, he thought he could live forever. So he was quite an interesting character.
There are a number of explanations for the rise of the right in the 1960s and the 70s as a backlash to the 60s, as a backlash to civil rights and the women's liberation movement, the 60s and 70s, against the counterculture, against the profound, if incomplete, societal changes that happened during that period. But you locate the rise of the right a decade earlier in the 1950s, where these people, these ultra-conservatives in particular within the Republican Party, were up in arms. What gave fuel to the ire of the ultra-conservatives in the 1950s? And what part did the civil rights movement of the 1950s play in generating that ire?
Crucial to the resurgence of the Republican Party in the South was their reversal among white citizens on the issue of race. As I said, the Republican Party had a lot of difficulty getting elected in the South. The traditional and kind of key to this process of making sure that the South could develop as a political party in the South was developing the Southern strategy. And the traditional narrative of the Southern strategy is that it came out of the events of the 1960s, the counterculture, the decline of traditional sexual activity, the decrease in union membership. The traditional narrative is that it's politicians like Barry Goldwater and Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan who developed this Southern strategy in the 1960s. I argue that they were developing this strategy a lot earlier in Dallas, and they had developed the Southern strategy as early as 1956. I argue that Dallas Republicans were blazing the trail for the GOP Southern strategy by making these racial appeals to white Democrats as early as 1956. And it is the seminal case of Brown versus Board of Education that drives the Republicans to, for in a few instances, political reasons. For political reasons, they make this change and they begin to develop the Republican strategy. And Bruce Alger is the first person to do that in 1956. His theory was that by becoming more reactionary than even the Southern Democratic Party, the Republican Party could attract Southern conservatives who had been Democrats. And then by consolidating those Southern Democrats with conservative strength in the Middle West and the Far West, the Republicans could offset the liberalism of the Northeast and win the South for good. I think that was that was definitely the strategy.
Edward H. Miller is my guest. We'll return with him in a minute to talk more about the resurgence of the right in the 1950s and 60s and the South. Thank you. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm joined by Edward H. Miller. He teaches at Northeastern University Global, and we're discussing his book, Nut Country, Right-Wing Dallas and the Birth of the Southern Strategy, which is published by the University of Chicago Press. You can find a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. We're just starting to talk about the kinds of politics that the ultra-conservatives within Dallas's Republican Party were pushing and helped not only push that party to the right, but shape the kinds of ideas that were to come out of the Republican Party for years, if not decades, to come. But for a moment, I just want to stay with the Dallas Republican Party and ask you about who subscribed to these ideas. You had mentioned H.L. Hunt, who was a billionaire, so the wealthiest person in the world at that point. Now, obviously, no one could be as wealthy as him by definition, but was the Republican Party in Dallas, and especially the ultra-conservative wing of it, composed of people from the business class, and then who supported the movement of the Republicans further to the right in terms of the rank and file? What was the class composition of leadership and rank and file?
There were two main figures in the Dallas Republican Party, Bruce Alger and John Tower, two elected main figures in the Dallas Republican Party, Bruce Alger and John Tower. And they received a lot of their support from the more affluent areas of North Dallas, and also these two enclaves in the middle of Dallas called the Park Cities, which consisted of Highland Park and University Park. A lot of the financial individuals who were working in finance and working in the oil industry resided in North Dallas, and these two affluent enclaves. Alger and Tower also received support from the suburban areas around Dallas, such as Grand Prairie and some of the other northern cities in the suburbs of North Dallas. But many of those folks were working in finance, working in the oil industry. But another key group that's important that really were instrumental to the rise of the Republican Party in Dallas were the women, who the housewives. They played a huge role in increasing the significance of the Dallas Republican Party. And it was Peter O'Donnell, who is the Dallas County Republican chairman. He said that women were the backbone of our effort. They were the ones who held the campaign signs. They were the ones who saw conservatism as a mission, and they almost felt as if they were pioneers. They were very significant in getting people to the polls and vote Republican. What happened was there was for many reasons there developed this interest in developing GOP clubs in the 1950s in Dallas. And it compared to the rest of the state, there were very few GOP clubs, but Republican clubs began to become very, very popular in Dallas in the mid-1950s. And what they did was they put together these women's clubs in Dallas County. And they worked to elect Bruce Alger to Congress. And then they worked to elect John Tower to the Senate. And they were very successful. They would address the envelopes, sign the letters of support for the Republican Party, work the phones. And they were very instrumental in making the Dallas Republican Party become a real power.
Well, let's talk about how these ideas that were articulated in the 1950s in the Dallas Republican Party, especially the ultra-conservative wing of the Republican Party, how these ideas that reoriented the party as a party supporting racial segregation very overtly, trying to appeal to other voters, white voters in the Democratic Party, and get them to vote Republican based on these racial appeals and this racial politics. How did that go from being the politics in a city, in a state, to politics that really shaped and changed the Republican Party on the national level?
It worked from going from Dallas to the state of Texas, and then it became a national strategy that was adopted by Barry Goldwater.
And Barry Goldwater, of course, being the Arizona senator who ran for the Republican Party as the presidential candidate in 1964 and lost by a landslide.
It started in 1956. The re-election campaign of Bruce Alger put race central into the conversation. What happened, there was the attempted desegregation of Mansfield High School introduced race into that 1956 election between Bruce Alger and his opponent, Henry Wade. And Alger moved quickly to the right on the issue of race. What drove the issue of race was the fact that this is only a couple years after the Brown decision, but there were a number of pastors who were introducing a spiritual defense of segregation, and that became a very popular way to support segregation in Dallas at the time, and almost supercharged the argument. And so Alger made this political decision to move to the right on race, and apparently it worked because he won the election in 1956. It was the first example of somebody using a Southern strategy to become reelected. And this became a continual effect. There were a number of individuals who would pursue the same policy. Now, the next individual who is going to do this is John Tower. Now, John Tower has been arguing as early as 1952 that Reconstruction is a burden to the development of the Republican Party. He basically says that we have to shed our association as the party of Thaddeus Stevens, as the party of Charles Sumner. So he's pushing the Republican Party to move to the right on race as early as 1952. But he's not in any position to do anything at that particular time. He doesn't have any real influence. But he's active in Republican politics. And at the 1960 Republican National Convention, he is a delegate for the Republican Party, and he led the drive by the Goldwater wing for a more pro-segregationist plank on civil rights. And then he runs for Senate in 1961, continues to push the party of Lincoln into the arms of the segregationists. He loses in 1960. He wins in 1961, and as a newly sworn-in senator, he goes to the Senate Southern Caucus. And during the meeting, the caucus leader, Senator Richard Russell of Georgia, Richard Russell is an arch segregationist, turns to Tower and says, "I want to welcome Texas back into the Confederacy." So obviously, the Texas Republican Party is beginning to replace the Democratic Party as the anti-civil rights party. And this process continues. We've seen in Alger, Alger focuses on one district in Dallas, but this is introduced now in Texas. And it continues on. In 1962, the Republicans put up somebody by the name of Jack Cox, who's from who lives near Dallas. He's he's going to be the GOP gubernatorial nominee in 1962. He is going to lose a very close election. He's going to lose against Governor John Conley, is elected the governor of Texas in 1962. But Cox was very anti-civil rights, and one supporter said that Cox had my vote because he's the only candidate who's unalterably opposed to the despicable, vicious civil rights bill. Cox is very much in opposed to civil rights. And then it moves to the national level. The Dallas GOP chairman, Peter O'Donnell, moves to Washington, D.C. and begins to work on the draft Goldwater campaign and encourages that the same use of the Southern strategy in the Goldwater campaign. And Goldwater pursued the Southern strategy by appealing to law and order. He also introduces a film by the name of Choice, which is a very racist film. And through other means, Goldwater also argues that the opposes the civil rights bill as an attack on property rights. Now, keep in mind that the that Goldwater really establishes the Republican Party as a party that is opposed to civil rights. In 1952, President Eisenhower got 44% of the African-American vote. In 1956, he got 40% of the African-American vote. In 1960, Richard Nixon got 36% of the African-American vote. Following the campaign of Barry Goldwater in 1964, the African-American vote was 6%, and the Republican Party has not gotten more than 15% of the African-American vote since 1964. Mitt Romney got 6% in 2012.
Right. Perhaps not surprising. Edward H. Miller is my guest. I'm talking to him about his book, Nut Country, Right-Wing Dallas and the Birth of the Southern Strategy. And my name is Sasha Lilly. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, of course, Goldwater, who put this kind of overt, racist, segregationist politics front and center, ended up losing, and of course, not just with African-American voters. He went down in kind of a landslide of defeat. What happened to the Southern strategy after Goldwater's massive defeat?
Well, as you mentioned, Senator Goldwater and Congressman Alger both lost in 1964. And what happened was it convinced their resounding loss, convinced many Dallas and national Republicans that the old ways of the Southern strategy, the old stratagems, like appealing to communism and asserting white supremacy, asserting the loss of property through the Civil Rights Act, they were no longer going to work. They were no longer going to be effective with the with enough of the electorate. And so what they did was they abandoned these thinly veiled appeals to racist sentiments. And they are thinly veiled appeals. These are not the type of bring the house down racial appeals that we see with Governor George Wallace. I'm not suggesting that Goldwater mirrored the language of George Wallace. They were thinly veiled appeals to racist sentiments. And so after 64, after the defeat, they, some of them at least, abandoned these thinly veiled appeals to racial sentiments, and they adopted a colorblind strategy of justice for all in order to widen their electoral reach.
So how do you see then the Southern strategy as shaped in the 50s in Dallas then becoming the widespread national politics of the Republican Party from Nixon to Reagan to people who actually achieve power?
Well, the big defeats of Goldwater and Alger lost in 1964, convinced many Dallas and many of the national Republicans that they had to change their ways, that they had to change their Southern strategies, and that the old stratagems, the appeals to fears of communism, of the appeals to loss of property, assertions of white supremacy, they were just not going to be as effective with enough of the electorate to win for the Republican Party. So some abandoned these thinly veiled appeals to racist sentiments and adopted a colorblind language of justice for all to widen the electoral reach. They introduced a discourse of tax relief and libertarian economics. But so the discourse changed, but at the same time, Reagan used dog whistles such as welfare queen, and began his presidential election in the Mississippi county, where in 1964 the civil rights activists were murdered so tragically. The Republican Party continued to pursue as a Southern strategy, the type of dog whistle politics that you saw with the Willie Horton ad in 1988. George H.W. Bush campaign produced the Willie Horton ad. So there was a continuation of this type of Southern strategy, even though the rhetorical strategies became less overtly racist.
Well, let me end by asking you about the legacy of the Southern strategy today within the Republican Party and Donald Trump as his politics relate to that tradition. Obviously, he doesn't come out of the South. He's not an evangelical, and in many ways, he's a very unusual Republican. But do you see the legacy of the politics that you've been discussing that came out of Dallas in the 50s at work in the Republican Party today or at work with Donald Trump today?
Well, I've seen it throughout the presidential campaign, not only with Donald Trump, but throughout the primaries, the Republican primaries. There has been a significant amount of conspiratorial thinking. That conspiratorial thinking was long characteristic of Nut Country in the 1950s, and I see that very much in vogue today. Conspiratorial thinking is one characteristic of the ultra-conservative Republicans, and Donald Trump, he consistently doubts the legitimacy of President Obama's birth certificate. And the apocalyptic, almost doomsday rhetoric that ultra-conservatives like H.L. Hunt and W.A. Criswell employed is very much part of our politics today, unfortunately. And it does little to improve our political discourse. I remember during the course of the primaries, Lindsey Graham said that he's running because the world is on fire. I mean, this is this type of apocalyptic, catastrophic discourse that is very familiar in that I became very familiar with in studying Dallas in the 1950s. Glenn Beck had mentioned that the passage of Obamacare is going to means the end of America as we know it. That sort of harkens back to what W.A. Criswell said about JFK's election to the White House being the end of religious freedom as we know it. And it's this the type of over-the-top frenzied style that we have in some of the campaigns today remind me of some of the things that were going on at the National Indignation Convention in Dallas in the early 1960s when J. Evetts Haley said that Tom Anderson is becoming a moderate. He only wants to impeach Earl Warren. J. Everett Haley said he wanted to hang Earl Warren. So that over-the-top frenzied language is sort of similar to what we have today in many quarters.
We are completely out of time. I've been speaking with Edward H. Miller. He is the author of Nut Country, Right Wing Dallas and the Birth of the Southern Strategy, which is published by the University of Chicago Press, and he teaches at Northeastern University Global. Thank you so much, Ted, for joining me today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. This was a lot of fun.
And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.